Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Carla Wills Brandon. She's an author and lecturer and a licensed marriage and family therapist. She's actually published 13 books, and we are going to discuss the one which I believe is her latest, called Heavenly Hugs, Comfort, Support and Hope from the Afterlife. So welcome to the program, Carla.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, it'd be very nice to talk with you. Sort of one of my favourite subjects. Now, I understand that you contact your mother quite regularly and speak with her, your mother having passed on. Was that the basis for you writing this book? In other words, have you been in contact with her for many years?
Well, when I was about 15 years old, back in California, I went to a rock concert with some of my friends, and the show started late, and so we were sitting there waiting, and suddenly I felt very, very ill. And there was an ambulance on the ground, and so I walked over to the ambulance and asked if I could lay down and crawled in and went to sleep and slept through the entire concert. When I woke up and got home, I found out that at that exact moment, my mother had been taken away in an ambulance to the hospital. A few days later, I was awakened at about 5 in the morning. I had just turned 16, and I had a knowing that my mother had passed on. And so I went downstairs and sat and waited by the phone, and sure enough, the phone rang, and I was told that she had moved on. At that exact same time, two family friends living in different locations also woke up at the exact moment of my mother's passing. Now, none of us talked to each other for many, many years about this. Just last year, I learned that my great aunt and my cousin had also awakened at the moment of her death. So that's five of us. Now, what I did after my mother passed was, of course, we live in a very death-phobic society. We're not supposed to talk about our grief. We're supposed to have the funeral, shed a few tears, and move on. So what I did is I tucked all of this behind me and pursued a career in clinical psychology and got into the field of trauma. And so I started working with severe trauma survivors, PTSD, war vets, sexual abuse. When the Challenger exploded, my husband and I worked with that tragedy. But what began to happen is that I began to notice that those people who came to see me would quietly report to me amazing experiences. If they had been at the deathbed of somebody who was getting ready to pass, they would share accounts involving all of a sudden their dying loved one looks over to the corner of the room and begins to talk about a deceased relative or friend that nobody else in the room could see. And I also began to gather accounts from surviving family and friends and healthcare workers who would share instances like this. A hospice worker was walking past a room. There was a man in the room who was getting ready to pass. His daughter was in the room caring for him. She was supposed to be off going home, but what she did is she went in there and she assisted the daughter in caring for the man. And then when she went home, she suddenly had a knowing that he had passed on, and she heard a thank you from him. And she immediately called the facility where he was and was told, yes, indeed, he had moved on. So some people can have awake experiences where their loved one comes to them in the form of an apparition. One account that I documented in the latest book was that of a grandmother who came to the home of a son, and the grandmother looked perfectly well. And when the son went to go see where the grandmother was outside, he received a notification that she had actually passed on at the moment he saw her at his house. She had passed on in her home. So the living can have these experiences. And then the dying can also have experiences where they have visions of afterlife, the next dimension. So in my personal encounters, yes, I have had encounters with my mother since she passed away so many, many years ago. But my main focus is in sharing with other people that physical death is not the end, that we don't have to be so frightened of physical death, that when we're not so frightened of physical death, we're not wrapped up with aging issues and neuroses that are a byproduct of death phobia, and that loosens us up to be seekers and to investigate our own spirituality, and it also allows us to live life more fully. And let me tell you something, this has been a hard road to trudge.
Yes, do you mean because of the opposition to what you're saying?
The oppositions, all one has to do is turn on the television. And the television, as I said, it's become very superficial. It's a lot of me, me, me. Materialism is the name of the game. And there's nothing wrong with having nice things. But when it becomes our God, that's a problem. And that's what I'm seeing in society today. I'm seeing actually an increase in atheism, which is very interesting, with younger generations. And I'm also seeing an inability to deal with loss in the younger generations, which is also difficult. Even my own generation, I'm 56 years old, I see an incredible amount of death phobia. As a lot of my generation is aging, it seems to be intensifying, which is, I find, really, really sad. So you have addictions that can cover up these feelings and certain behaviors that can cover up these feelings. But yes, as far as skeptics go, I've had my fair share of encounters with some of these materialistic skeptics who haven't really looked at the research on the departing vision. When I first got into this 30 years ago and started looking at accounts myself, beginning with Sir William Barrett, who was a physicist at the end of the 1800s, and he published one of the first collections on deathbed visions, departing visions, in 1926. It came out a year after his passing. He and his wife was a surgeon, a gynecological surgeon, and so during those years, women often died when they gave birth to children, and so witnessing departing visions was not that uncommon. So beginning with him and then moving to Carlos Osis and Erlinger Haraldsson, who is actually still alive, two psychologists from Iceland who were and are with universities, who did huge, huge studies into the departing vision after taking a look at Barrett's research. What they did was they put together a interview and they passed this interview out to thousands upon thousands of medical people, not only in the United States, but in India. And what they did is they asked very specific questions about what did you notice about your patient as death drew near. And what they discovered was that these experiences were very consistent from person to person, regardless of religion, regardless of gender, age, regardless of culture, where as one drew closer to passing, they began talking about being visited not by the mailman or the grocery clerk or your next-door neighbor who is still alive, but always by the deceased. Every now and then an angel would appear or a religious icon, but for the majority of the reports, it was a deceased relative or friend. And they found that medications didn't explain it, lack of oxygen to the brain didn't explain it, hallucinations, these were not hallucinations, which I can validate because if I have 10 people walk into my office, and they are coming to see me that day because they want to work on their hallucinations, each person, their hallucinations from person to person will be very different. they will be specific to that person. If 10 people come into my office talking about having departing visions, what will happen is that there will be real consistency. They have had a dream that their dying loved one came to them in a dream, or they had a premonition that an upcoming death was about to occur, or they received a message from another deceased relative that one of their living relatives was going to be moving on. So there's consistency. Well, that's what was found in this huge study that was done in the 60s and 70s. And since then, you have Peter Fenwick in the UK, who has done extensive research not only into the near-death experience, where people come close to dying, they leave the body, they go through a tunnel, go toward a light, meet up with guides or deceased relatives and loved ones, and then return, as Ibn Alexander recently shared in his best-selling book. Nothing more rewarding than a neurologist who is able to look at his own brain scans and explain to the population that, yes, he truly was dead when he had his near-death experience. But Peter Fenwick, there has been research that's been going on in Ireland, Italy, Holland. Even the VA in California did some research into the departing vision. And they're all finding the same thing, that the skeptics, I just got a video yesterday. Somebody sent me a video, a Dr. Sherman, who is well known for his research into the physiology of death. And I actually met him years ago. And again, here I hear that, well, these experiences have to do with a lack of oxygen to the brain, and they're hallucinations, and they have to do with the cells in the retina dying, and so we see X, Y, and Z, and the chemistry released in the brain. Well, all of the research is saying over and over again, no, that's not true. But this is not a popular topic, because we're not supposed to talk about these things. So getting the information out there is really, really difficult.
Yes, I suppose a lot of that has to do with the way people have been brought up, isn't it?
Well, several hundred years ago, when somebody was getting ready to pass, what would happen is they would pass in their own bed at home. They didn't pass in nursing homes, and they didn't pass in hospitals. The elderly were taken in by their family, and they lived with their families until the very end. And so when the end came, or if somebody became very ill, or if there was, like in my family's case from Russia, there was a tractor accident, so yeah. This relative of mine was taken to the house and was placed on a bed, and the family was surrounded the bed, and everybody said their goodbyes and cried, and possessions were distributed, and this particular relative did have a departing vision. I found it in an obituary when I was doing research on my family. But if there was visitation from a departed relative or friend, this information would be shared with those standing around the bed. Children were not whisked away. Taken away from the room of the dying. They were allowed to stay. They were allowed to be a part of the experience, the community experience, the family experience. And so what this did is this normalized for children that, one, death is just a transition, and that, two, death is nothing to be fearful of, and that, three, physical death isn't the end, and that there is a soul, or there is a part of us, consciousness, that survives. So during those times, death was not seen as something that was... Men would go into battle, and they would know they were going to most likely die, but they would go into battle anyway. It was just not seen as the big boogeyman. Whereas today, when somebody becomes maybe a little feeble-minded, or they're whisked off to a nursing home, or if they are if they I have a cousin who passed a couple of months ago, and we had to really, really fight for her to die at home. She had pancreatic cancer, and so the hospital, they gave us a very hard time about allowing her to come home, even though they knew she was going to be moving on within a month. Another friend of mine, an elderly gentleman with lung cancer, he had to fight, too, to die at home. So our culture is so obsessed with things being tidy and things being a certain way that we have lost the normalcy of physical death. And so it has become something that is very, very scary for us. With my own children, we have normalized that. When I was a child and my mother had passed, nobody said a word about death, dying, what happens after you die, what a corpse is, what the coffin looks like. And I remember showing up for her funeral, and I walked up to where her coffin was, and I bent over, and I kissed her on the cheek, and I was totally stunned by the experience. I was not prepared at all. My son, my oldest son, on the other hand, he decided that he wanted to see his grandmother when his grandmother passed away. And so we prepared him, and we let him know what it is he needed to expect. And he walked in, and he took one look at her, and he went, "Oh, no one's home." And he turned around, and he walked out. So, but I think in our culture, I have people who will come in when there is a passing, and they will want to keep their teenage kids home and not allow them to go to a funeral. And if their children are in primary school, they definitely want to keep them home. So, and if children have some sort of afterlife experience, if all of a sudden they see grandma sitting there in a chair and grandma's died a couple of days before that, and so they have an after-death communication, and then they go to their parents and they say, "Mommy, Mommy, Daddy, Daddy, I just saw grandma sitting in a chair." Well, what are the parents going to think? Well, it's the stress of the family. It's an overactive imagination. So, yeah, it's a pretty overwhelming uphill battle, to say the least.
From what you just mentioned there about young people perhaps seeing the deceased when they come back, in my own experience with my friends, I believe that happens quite often.
Well, that is called an after-death communication. And so it sounds like you've had some of those. And they work several different ways. We can have after-death communications in dream form where we're asleep. A good example would be my grandmother. My grandmother basically raised me after my mother had passed. And so when she finally passed on, I was devastated. I just didn't know how I was going to deal with not having her in skin in my life. And so one night she came to me in a dream, and she looked very fit and very well, and the colors were very intense in the dream, which is something that's often reported. The dream imprinted on me, and she took me by the shoulders, and she shook me, and she told me to get over it, and then she turned around and walked away, which was her style. Dreams, we dream every night, even if we don't remember our dreams. We can have dreams which are stress-related. They're usually symbolic. A typical example would be, my favorite one is, I never passed high school, and here I am, I'm an adult. Or giving a presentation, and we're naked in our dream, feeling unclothed and exposed. Those are stress-related dreams, and we have all of them, and those are healthy for us, and they keep us emotionally fit. Then there are dreams that are related to tragedy and trauma, PTSD dreams, where we will have dreams about maybe something that happened to us that was very painful, that we haven't healed from, and we'll have it over and over and over again. It's repetitive. And then once we go and work through whatever that issue is, then what happens is the dream goes away. Or we have some sort of anxiety issue and we are having these sorts of dreams, and if we see the right therapist, the therapist will use those dreams to uncover what's really going on. So those are also very healthy. But then we have the dreams where they are very intense. Our deceased loved ones come to us with a message. I had another dream where I was sitting on top of a hill, walking up a hill, and I was with a deceased relative, and we were sitting on a bench. And we had a little conversation, and we had a hug, and then the relative went one way, and I went another way. So, and that was that's a delightful dream. But then there are those experiences, those after-death communications, where we have our loved ones manifest before us. I had all of my deceased relatives manifest in front of me in spirit energy form. And that was a very overwhelming experience, and I couldn't talk about it for probably 4 years. Then some individuals, like yourself, may have encounters where the deceased totally manifest and they look very solid. Or sometimes I was talking to a gentleman last night who was talking about how a relative of his had lost a child, and that child had come to him and kept badgering him to give information to his mother. So, but those are all forms of after-death communication.
Yes. Do you think that those that have passed over have, shall we say, like a totally free run as far as giving information back to people on the earth? In other words, if they had too much of a free hand, would that not in some ways be perhaps interfering with their life?
Well, also it would be interfering with our life. I think that when we cross over and go to the other side, that what happens is that we are greeted by those who have gone before us, and we are given the opportunity to review the lessons that we have learned while we were here. This world is very constricting. This material world is very dense and constricting, and our relationships are very challenging. And so the bottom line is we're supposed to be spiritually evolving, and we can't spiritually evolve if everything is peachy keen, so that's why we need constriction. So when we cross over to the other side, what happens is, as I said, we review all of this, and some seers have suggested that we go to school and we learn more. Others have suggested that we discuss reincarnating again so that we can come back and work some more on our own spiritual evolution. Others have talked about how groups of individuals will reincarnate together. So if they give us... Now, I can tell you for a fact that when I'm having a bad day and my relatives, my dear ones, who I have seen in spirit form, when I am in a bad mood, I can tell you, I let them have it because I feel like they should be, like, getting me out of jams and helping me. And I sound just like I'm about 5 years old throwing a temper tantrum. Well, if they were to whisk in and fix everything for me, well, they would be taking away from me the opportunities for growth that I need to be experiencing for myself. And also, their journey is continuing. So for whatever it is that they do, that we do once we cross over to the other side. So I think that opportunities for communication do happen. Mediumship is healthy mediumship. Now, there are a lot of folks out there who say they are psychics, and what they do is they just provide a cold reading, and then they charge $500 for a half an hour, and that's deplorable. But there are mediums who really are the real deal, mediums who have studied either at Arthur Findlay in the UK or some of the mediums who are at Lilydale here in the States, who they are able to communicate regularly and easily with the other side, but only to a degree because, as I said, I think the constriction for us here on this side is here for a reason. And we may only be given enough information to push us into beginning to explore. So when I finally pulled out my departing visions after I had started working with trauma survivors and really took a look at them, well, what that did is that opened up for me more experiences. I was at a place in my life where it was time for me to begin to experience some more. And then things shut down for a while I was raising my children, and then things opened up again. So it's come in spurts, because I'm not a full-fledged medium who has that constant access. So I think that what we learn from this is that there is a bridge from this life to the next.
Yes. Yes, I agree with you. And I notice that sometimes, I mean, it is only from experiences I read about, that souls on the other side do seem to be allowed to contact their friends or relatives in the event that there's some kind of danger to them. I wouldn't say that happens every time, otherwise perhaps there'd never be any accidents, but it does surprise me sometimes how often they step in and help a person avoid a disaster of some kind.
Well, what you're talking about is a crisis apparition or a crisis intervention where they will come. They will come and they will assist us when we're in a jam. A really good friend of my mother's was really concerned about my mother when she was dying. Because as I said, back then, you didn't talk about death and dying, and she was a 38-year-old woman, and she had just gone through barbaric chemotherapy and radiation treatments, and she was dying. And so her friend wanted to do something for her but didn't know what to do. And so she happened to be in a bookstore, and she was beside herself. She said, what on earth can I get for Carol to bring her some comfort? And suddenly she had a vision of what I call an angel, I'll just leave it at that, a wingless, no wings, who told her what book to get. And then the book was right on the bookshelf. And so she grabbed the book, and when she looked back, the image had disappeared. And the book was The Prophet, and it gave my mother great comfort. But there are situations where somebody is in trouble. And working with trauma survivors, a very fascinating phenomenon, and I started to use it clinically, and I know that my peers totally and wholeheartedly disagree with me doing this, but it works. I had a couple of trauma survivors report that while they were being sexually abused or experiencing their trauma, they would have out-of-body experiences, and they would be greeted by what they termed a higher being or an angel, and that higher being or angel would assist them in surviving the experience or keep them out of the body until after the event had passed on. And so I began using that in my work with trauma survivors, where we would actually create a room, a safe room in the mind's eye where the person could go emotionally if they needed to feel safe. And what they would do is they would, for themselves, determine whether they were going to have a deceased relative in there or an angel or a higher being in there to help them feel safe. But I've also heard other experiences where there have been car wrecks, and while waiting for ambulances to show up, deceased relatives have come and said everything's going to be okay. Or during times of hardship, an individual will have a dream where they will be told that everything's going to be okay. I was very, very sick. I have Crohn's disease, which is an autoimmune disorder. and I treat it holistically, but there was a time when something was really, really wrong. And I had a crisis dream where I was told basically what was wrong with me and what it was I needed to do to heal and get well. And so, and it worked out really, really well. So I think that there is so much that we just don't know. And that's why I get so frustrated, because materialistic science, it seems as though we will gain some ground, those of us that do this sort of work, and what will happen is that the skeptics will double their efforts, and suddenly you will see more of them on television, and none of them have really looked at the research into after-death communications or near-death experiences or deathbed visions. The PsyCops, the Skeptical Inquirer, they did a big article on after-death experiences, and they included me in there, and I really just had to laugh, because it was with regard to the first book I did on departing visions, which was called One Last Tug Before I Go. And what they did is they didn't pull out of that book the research I had cited, and they didn't, which was very credible statistical analysis. I mean, it was good research. They didn't pull out modern day accounts. They didn't pull out accounts. I had an account in there where a man was very, very sick. He had three children who would come and visit him. One of the children didn't visit very often. That one child was murdered. The family decided not to tell him about this. He wasn't in a place where he could read or watch television, so he didn't know that this child had been murdered. And so the two surviving children tried to continue as if everything was fine. And one day the man said, "It's so nice to have all of my children here." And then he said, "Oh, my son, he's not here. He's over there." And what he was talking about was his son was in the afterlife. And as a matter of fact, the woman who shared this account with me, she said her father, when she questioned her father about where he thought his other son was, just gave her a look as if she was as dumb as dirt. But, you know, as opposed to, and I included that in the book, but instead of pulling something like that out of the book, they pulled out an account that was from the mid-1800s that was very credible. It was a Sir William Barrett account, but what they did is they went through it and they tore it apart because of how old it was and a few other things. And so my experience with the skeptics has been that they're not very honest with the public. But if there's anything paranormal discussed on television, what will happen is that one of them will also appear, and they will not have researched the topic. But because they have presence, they will be seen as credible. And so that makes it really hard for the rest of us to do what it is we need to do to assist the public in recognizing that physical death is nothing to really fear.
Yes, I've noticed that myself, that they pick the cases they want to refer to that seem to support their ideas, and obviously they're not going to refer to the ones that actually prove the opposite. So they're not treating people fairly, but then I think people are not really idiots. They can often see through these skeptics and what they're trying to do. So maybe we don't take any notice of them, because in the end the truth comes out and it will put them in their place.
Well, I think if people like yourself with your radio show and myself keep chipping away at this, and what we can do is we can be of service. I have individuals who will come in. They'll come in for marital counseling, or they'll come in for an addiction, or they'll come in for trauma, and we'll do the work and we'll slug away and get that resolved. And then they'll look at me and they will say, I have something I need to share with you that I have never told another soul. So I had a lawyer who came in. He was concerned about his daughter, and we did the work on the daughter, and then he said, I have something I need to share with you. And of course, you know, oftentimes I even have, they will say things like, now, you know I have a job, and you know I have my teeth, and you know, they have to qualify themselves so that I don't think they're crazy. And what this lawyer said, he talked about his father who had Alzheimer's. And oftentimes, Alzheimer patients, if they have a departing vision before they pass, what they will do is they will wake up right before they cross over, and they will be very lucid, and they might even have conversation with family at the bedside. But what his father did was he woke up, he turned and he looked at the family, and he said, I love you, and he said, I'll be okay. And then he turned back toward the ceiling, and he looked up toward the ceiling, and he lifted his hands up, and then he sat up in bed, and he said, he called out the name of somebody who was deceased. And then he died very peacefully. So when people come to my office, or I also do contract work in a number of locations with regard to just marriage and family therapy. Every once in a while, somebody will quietly seek me out, and they will ask me some questions. And my job is to just validate their experiences and to let them know that, look, the brain does not, consciousness is not created by the brain. Consciousness is non-local. Individuals who go out of their body, like Robert Monroe, the foremost frontier grandfather with regard to out-of-body experiences, yes. They go out of body, and they have traveled these other dimensions, and they have come in contact with the deceased, or higher beings. How can this be? How can they have these experiences if the brain controls consciousness? Or what I will say to them is, look at quantum physics. Investigate how quantum physics is showing us that not everything is what we think it is, that there really is more to what meets the eye. Go online, and I like to tell people I'm not really, when it comes to some of this stuff, I'll go look up information on quantum physics for children when I need it explained to me. But go take a look at some of this stuff. Examine these people who have had near-death experiences. There are tons of these accounts online. And notice how similar they are, and that these people come from all walks of life, but they all provide the same sort of account. How can a dying brain account for compassion and love and care and creativity? A dying brain, that doesn't make any sense. Logistically, that's not going to make any sense. So that's what I try to do in my own little world, in my own little way, me, myself, and a few people who are doing the same thing I do.
Yes. Well, obviously, if people are out of the body or have passed over, and they can still come to someone and relate to them in a perfectly, as you might say, normal, sensible way, then it would be pretty obvious that when that physical brain dies, it's not the end of their consciousness, far from it.
Well, also remote viewing. I mean, that's such an easy thing to investigate. People can go online and look that up. But to experience or explore remote viewing and recognize, wow, isn't it wild that I'm sitting here in this location and I've kind of identified what's going on with this person over here. What's that about? And working with some of my clients, every once in a while, I will be able to tap into their history before they share it with me. And I have to be really, really careful because not everybody wants to hear what it is I've discovered before they're ready. So how are some of these things possible? there's so much to learn. Or these individuals who have had these near-death experiences, and what ends up happening is they can go to the waiting room. Their consciousness travels, that point of consciousness travels to the waiting room, and they can hear everything that their loved ones are saying. And then once they are back in the body and they come to, they can report back everything that was said. Or accounts involving departing visions where, and these are some of my favorite, where somebody will have a departing vision and they will be greeted by somebody the family isn't familiar with at all. But then the family goes and does some genealogy work and they discover that, wow, this was a relative of my parent, of my grandparent. This really was somebody who did come to greet them. So looking at some of these things that support that whole sense of consciousness not being a byproduct of the brain, investigating some of the new research that's coming out on non-local consciousness, that also is another great place to start. You know, some individuals, I'm one of those feeler people. If I get bogged down with too much information, I get lost. My husband, on the other hand, he wants to read the black and white print. That's just the way he is. And so there are people out there who just need to read the black and white print first, and then it becomes less frightening.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And thinking of how people that have passed over seem to want to make pretty quick contact at times, I'm always amused in a way at their attempts to get people's attention by moving things around or letting something appear in a manner of speaking that would remind them of that person. For example, I read of a lady whose husband only ever smoked a certain type of cigarette or certain tobacco in his pipe. And every now and again, she could smell that, and she realized it was him letting her know that he was there. And I would imagine you've come across quite a bit of that.
Well, I live in a 100-year-old house, and so we had a visitor here. And for a while, the visitor was, there was a rose smell in this house, and there's not a rose bush anywhere near this house. And one day, there was a knock on the door, and a 90-something-year-old man was standing there with a 60-year-old girlfriend, and he said that he had been married to one of the daughters who had grown up in this house. And so he asked if he could come in, and he came in and he told us about the house and who had slept where. And just in passing, I asked him about roses, if anybody had worn rose perfume or had roses in the house. And he said, oh, my mother-in-law used to keep rose petals in dishes around the house. Well, the woman hadn't been in the house for probably at least 60 years. So I think what I like to think is that they were visiting to see who had moved into their house. Now, the house next door, there was a man who lived to be 105, and he had a wicked, wicked sense of humor. And when he passed, his house alarm started going off. So every morning at 2 in the morning, my husband would run over there with a baseball bat, thinking somebody was breaking in, and of course nobody was ever there. And we got the grandson to disarm the alarm. And so even after the alarm was disarmed, it still went off at 2 o'clock. And so we're pretty sure that he was letting us know that he was still around, and he was a prankster, too. So some people will have contact through a telephone. My editor, one of my editors, after her mother passed, she received a phone call from her deceased mother. Some people will have the full apparition. Other people will have the experience where lights go off and on. Some people find pennies. In one instance, a family they kept finding feathers all over the place. And they would clean up the feathers, and then the feathers would just suddenly reappear. Those on the other side, sure. I mean, they will work very, very hard to let us know. If they are in a position to do so, they will work very hard to let us know that they are okay. Now, I had two clients commit suicide, one cousin commit suicide, and one friend commit suicide. Mm-hmm. And I did make contact with some help. I did make contact with the friend who committed suicide, but with the other three, I haven't made contact. And I think that the way we die also impacts our ability to connect with our loved ones in this realm. So when somebody commits, we take ourselves to the other side. It's not like we go to the other side and are struck wonderful and happy and everything's peachy keen. I mean, if we have issues on this side that we haven't worked out, well, we're going to drag those to the other side with us. So if I commit suicide because I'm in so much pain, well, when I get to the other side, I'm going to have that pain to deal with over there. Now, I believe that there are avenues for healing over there, for taking care of ourselves over there, that we can get some help for that. But I also believe that, I have people who will say to me, well, my husband was suddenly killed in a car accident, or my daughter committed suicide, and I don't understand why I haven't heard from them right away. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I do believe that based on whatever that person was going through, that they are going through some healing on the other side now. So, like I said, each situation is a little bit different. I mean, some people will go to the other side and they will have made a pact. There was this woman friend of mine. She was a brilliant author. She did a lot of automatic writing. And she and I had an agreement that she would somehow get in touch with me when she crossed over. Well, when she crossed over, I started having this vision of her. And it was a vision of her having a ball, and it was just out of the blue, absolutely out of the blue. And she was flying, and she was in the stars, and she was having a grand old time, and I even asked, is this you? And she said, well, of course it's me. And that I couldn't shake it, and I knew that that was her. She was also a friend of NDE researcher Bruce Grayson. So I quickly sent him an email and I said, you're not going to believe who I just got a message from. And I've had a couple of those. I had another one where a woman passed and she had been very ill, and she's all of a sudden, and she and I weren't friendly. We weren't that friendly. But suddenly I felt badgered by her, and there was this sense of, I was supposed to let her husband know that she was okay. And I said to her, I said, I think he's having a really rough time. And all of a sudden I heard, well, he will get over it. And I was kind of like, oh, my goodness sakes. And so what I did is thankfully this was somebody I could share this information with. And so I shared the information with him, and he was very, very, He felt relieved when he received that information. So I know that there has been research on the soul leaving the body or the essence leaving the body, and I have several chapters in this book about some of that, where my husband saw his father's soul leave the body, begin to leave the body. And my husband is your basic meat and potatoes kind of guy, so for him, this was his awakening. He had decided to spend the night at his father's bedside, and he saw pastel vaporous mist leave his father's chest area. And then a cousin of ours also saw her mother's soul leave the body, and she called it a bluish gray white mist leave the body. Mm. So people who if they have been ill for a while, there's a researcher in Russia who has actually measured at what rate the soul will leave the body by weighing the body as people are passing. And what he found out was that people who die in accidents, that the soul leaves very quickly. That people who are very, very ill, the life energy leaves very slowly. Now, he's a physicist, too, and any of your listeners who are interested in his research are free to contact me, and I'll be glad to give you information about him.
Right. Now, you mentioned this person, this Russian, and his investigation into the soul. I also remember reading about someone who weighed the body before the soul had departed and found that when they reweighed the body afterwards, there was actually a slight discrepancy in the weight, which I thought was interesting.
Well, and that's, you know, I see, I like my friend's research because he uses Kirlinger photography and he also takes into account vapor from the body that leaves with death. I think I probably read the same material that you read, and that was, it was a few years back, if I'm not mistaken. And I think that that sort of experimentation right now still is so highly criticized.
Yes.
Highly criticized. But what I can tell you is that the next work that I'm going to be putting together is going to be focusing in exclusively on those accounts where witnesses have seen something leave the body. There was one account that I included in this recent book from Sweden where a man was being operated on by physicians, and there were nurses present. And as he passed, they saw a bluish orb mist leave his chest area. And all of them were just absolutely floored by this. So I have numerous accounts in this most recent book, but I really, really do want to put an entire book together on just that, looking at past accounts and present accounts, because I think that also that is often dismissed too, because nobody wants to talk about that. They want to say, did I really see that? I don't know about you, but every once in a while I have just seen, if I'm in an old building or something, I have seen like a floating mist with a little bit of form, but not a ton, maybe skirt along the ceiling or something. And I was in a really old, I live on a very old historical island, so we have a lot of old buildings around here, but yeah. I was at a meeting, and I was just sitting in the meeting, and I noticed this something float on by, and I just made a mental note of it. But I think that there really is something going on here, but nobody really wants to talk about this either because they don't want to be seen as a loon. So, as I said, 200 years ago when these things were happening, people talked about this. They talked about openly about visitations from deceased relatives and loved ones after a passing. That was just kind of seen as normal. It was very refreshing to watch these mediums at Lilydale. They openly talk about communication. It's like, what's the weather today? It's not seen as anything unusual. And if we could only get that sort of mindset going in the rest of our population, I think that that would be great.
Absolutely, and I think, as you said at the start of the program, which is one of your objectives by writing your books, people really do need to understand and accept that there is no such thing as death, and then their whole life and the way they look at it and the events they experience would take on an absolutely different colour then.
The thing that's so funny, it's like I have cared for a number of very ill friends, and I watched them, as they as they deteriorated. And and a friend of mine said to me, Are you having a hard time with this? You know, they're going to die. Do you have a hard time with death and dying? And I said, no, I have a hard time. I would have a hard time living like this. I'd be really ready to move on. And my poor friend, she looked at me aghast. I mean, I don't think she expected that from me. No. And I said, no, death would be hallelujah. It's over with. Years ago, I was on Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher, one of the biggest skeptics in the United States with regard to the paranormal. And I had been invited to be on that show. They were doing a Halloween show, and so, of course, you know, paranormal, have Carla on. And so when I showed up to do the show, I was on with George Hamilton, who is a movie star, and then another little movie star, some girl, real cute girl. And then I think I was on with a very skeptical surgeon from Harvard. I was supposed to be on with Randy from the Skeptical Inquirer, and then he didn't show up, and I was quite relieved, actually. But in sitting and doing that show, Maher was not real happy about the topic. He was not happy, and his producers had set it up. And so one of the questions he asked was, what do you want on your tombstone? And so everybody said what it was they wanted on their tombstone, and what I said was, I survived.
Yes.
And he did not know what to do with that. He looked very perplexed, and he quickly wanted to end the discussion of the topic. But I was serious. I survived. George Hamilton wanted to continue the topic, and so did the other little gal. And so we continued, much to Mars' chagrin. But my point being that here is an individual who has such a platform, and I'm honestly asked a question, and I'm basically ridiculed. But it was okay, because there were those in the audience who got it. Then I was asked to do the Howard Stern radio show, and that in and of itself was an experience in constriction and tolerance and mindful purpose. And he threw a few things out there that were a bit difficult, but I just kind of trudged along. Because what I said to myself was, I'm going to do this show because I know that there are at least a couple of people out there who want to hear about life after death, who don't just want to hear about sex and guns and rock and roll. So, and I was right. Because I did. I got some emails from some experiencers who, and it was the usual thing. I have never told anybody this ever, and I don't know where to go to get some information, and you're the first person I've heard talk about this. And these are people who, they don't even know what the New Age movement is. They don't watch programs that have to do with ghosts or afterlife experiences. They're raising families and trying to put food on the table. So since those days, I don't do that many of those types of shows anymore. But it is very, very sad that these individuals with these huge platforms, they don't use them for betterment. It's as if they want to take the topic and push it to the side even more. And I think that's really sad.
Yeah. Do you think it makes any difference as to whether people get this type of contact if they don't believe in God?
Oh, absolutely not. I think that doesn't mean a thing, no, because atheists have had these experiences. And what it does is that if an atheist has a departing vision, a near-death experience, or an after-death communication, what that does is it puts them on a path. Mm. And so their perception of what God is may be different than somebody else's. Maybe theirs becomes something like they get as far as, okay, so the brain does not produce consciousness. Consciousness can happen outside the body. And they may take that reading the words in black and white, seeking sort of behavior, but that's a start. and they may never develop a concept of God, higher power, universal life force, but they do know that they're going to survive physical death. So that's not unusual at all. They learn that there is more to this physical world. I think that people oftentimes they get real tied up in hearing that we have, this is our earth and we have these certain rules about how our earth was formed and that we have this universe and we have certain rules about this universe. And any thought to going beyond that is referred to as an existential crisis. And so that's a very uncomfortable place to be. And so most people will stop at that. And you have, when people are developing spiritually, there is a process for it. Kids will go to a religious service or some sort of spiritual activity on a regular basis because their parents tell them to go, because their parents want them to have a foundation to begin with. Then they will go when they get a little bit older because there's some cute guy or cute gal in there and their friends are there or they've got donuts there or something, you know. So they go because they have different reasons for going. They want to go. They want to go for all the Dr. Pepper they can drink. Then what happens is that a lot of folks will hit that stage of atheism. They'll question everything. They'll think that they'll become despondent with traditional religion, especially if they've been exposed to any hypocrisy. And so what they'll do is for a time is they'll kind of throw a lot of it out. And because they're so young, what they'll do is they'll do life until a crisis erupts. And then they'll start seeking. And they may return to their religion. They may return to the philosophies they were raised with. They may or just start seeking out on their own or all of the above. What will happen is they'll be very skeptical for a while, but they will be seeking. And then eventually they'll get to a place where it's okay not to know everything, but that's really okay. It's okay to know that there are a lot of things that happen that we don't understand, but all I need to know is that they do happen. What happens when you have, there are certain, atheism is a form of religious addiction. And atheists hate hearing this, but it really is. It's a form, and also materialism is a form of addiction. The addiction is just as potent as would be for, let's say, a fundamentalist of some religion, where they are addicted to the structure of the religion. It's canned, it's boxed, it provides all answers. I don't have to think for myself, and so they're stuck. They get very, very stuck. And unfortunately, that happens with a lot of people, is that they get very, very stuck. And then what will happen is that if they question if they have a departing vision or they witness a departing vision or a near-death experience, if they go to their clergy person, well, their clergy person will poo-poo it or not give it any credence or provide them with information to read so that they can understand what it is they've experienced. Or certain religions will say, well, you're doing the devil's work. And so what that will do is shut them down and they won't talk. If they go to their physician or try to talk to their physician may use all of the above, hallucination, dying brain, some of the things that we have discussed. And so what they will do is they won't continue any further. If they see somebody in my field, oftentimes what happens is it'll be seen as, you were under stress, that was that, again, a hallucination, wishful thinking. They will be shipped off to a psychiatrist for some pharmaceuticals. So, as I say, our institutions are not very supportive. If they can catch a radio show like yours or pick up one of my books or somebody else's books or meet with a clergy who does have information or a physician who does have information or a therapist who does have information, and if they are validated in their experience, then, and if they are given some healthy direction for what to look at, what to read, what things to search out online, any support groups that are available, which there are. Then what happens is they begin to, after being validated, they begin to expand spiritually. And that expanding period can be very painful because when we expand spiritually, we also have to confront all those things we've been avoiding, any past hurt that we have, any past losses that we haven't dealt with. I haven't met an atheist yet who hasn't had some sort of hurtful past loss. We have to confront if we have some addictions or some behaviors that aren't real healthy, if we have regrets. We have to deal with all that stuff. So after my husband had a near-death experience, this meat and potatoes psychologist, licensed clinical psychologist, where black is black and white is white, he had to go do a whole lot of his own work. He had to go heal a lot of himself. And then after that, he was able to begin looking into spirituality at large and seeing all of the different things out there without being so closed-minded. So it is a process. It's a process, and unfortunately, it's not a process that a lot of people want to take.
Mm-hmm. I think spirit have a wonderful way of making sure that sometimes you get those experiences which really start you on another path. Now, a little bit early on, you used a phrase that I thought was very interesting. You were speaking about a friend or someone whose experience was related to, and you said she was beside herself. That's a very interesting expression, isn't it?
Beside herself.
Yeah, beside.
Refresh my memory.
Well, what I'm thinking is probably in different situations when someone perhaps has had a shock or something like that, they may be temporarily out of their body. So you could use the expression that they're beside themselves. It's only a thought of mine.
I think people, what I can say is that I went to Raymond Moody's house years ago, years and years and years ago. Raymond Moody is the grandfather of the near-death experience research. At that time, he was investigating what is called the psychomantium, which is based on mirror gazing, which was used in ancient times. In Greece and thousands of years ago, the mystics would gaze into a pond or they would gaze into a bowl of water and they would make contact with the other side or they would look for premonitions. And this was regular, like I said, run-of-the-mill behavior. And so he was very into this. And so Dr. Barbara Romer, she has passed on, but she investigated hellish near-death experiences, and she was a real hoot, and I just loved her to pieces. She was a physician, myself, and several other people. I think one of them was also, I think, an alternative medicine person. But there were probably about eight of us, and we met at Moody's house, and he had psychomantiums built into his house, and Diane Sawyer from 2020 had even come and spent some time with Moody to talk to him about this. And I was incredibly skeptical about the psychomantium, but I wanted to go because I thought it would be a good experience. And so no alcohol was allowed, no drugs were allowed, no smoking was allowed, and the food that we ate was light and vegetarian. And each of us were given the opportunity to visit these psychomantiums. And what a psychomantium is it's a pitch black room, little room, with a chair and a mirror. And it's just a plain old mirror. There are no lights behind the mirror, no nothing special. They are Walmart mirrors. And so I went into three of the psychomantiums, and my grandmother had just passed. And so I went in, and I would sit and grieve and feel sad and cry and miss her. Mm. That evening, I think we had a lecture or two, and then we had dinner, and I thought, well, I think I'm going to just retire, and suddenly I had one of those nudges that you were just talking about. The door opened, and I had this nudge to go to the final psychomantium, and so I thought, oh, what the heck. So I went in again expecting absolutely nothing, sat down, and immediately the temperature dropped, and it became very, very chilly. Mm. And then I looked with the mirror, what I saw a bluish-white light begin to pour out of that mirror, just pour out, and there were orbs and vectors of light, and they were whirling around me, and at first I was a bit spooked, and I started to say to myself, what can I learn from this? What can I learn from this? What can I learn from this? Which is a really good tool for any of your listeners. And it calmed me down immediately, and I just watched. Well, one of the facilitators walked by, and she said, how are you doing? And I told her what was going on, and she went, oh, my. And she said, do you want to continue or do you want to leave? And I said, I think I want to continue. And so she moved on, and I could hear Raymond talking on the phone about some domestic issues, lawn, yard, gardening or something. And it started up again. And this time, an orb of light went straight through me in the area of my heart, and it was the most intense feeling of love I have ever, ever experienced. I felt the orbs began to touch me, and I instinctively knew this was all of my deceased loved ones and relatives were all here for me, and they were letting me know that they're okay and that they are here for me. And so another participant came by. He wasn't a very nice person. He came by and he demanded to be allowed to use the psychomantium, and immediately everything disappeared. And I left the psychomantium, and I was in tears. I was in tears. I was beside myself. I didn't have words to describe. It took me 4 years to find words to describe what I had experienced, and I still don't think I describe it very well. But I went and I found the facilitator, and I talked to her, and then I debriefed it with Raymond, and I was just a sniveling mess for the rest of the weekend. And when I came home, I told one woman friend, and I told my husband, but then I wrote it down. I made sure I wrote it down. And as I said, I didn't talk about it openly for a number of years, and I didn't put it in any of my writings until I wrote my second book, A Glimpse of Heaven. I finally put the account in there. So beside myself, for me, means it's unexplainable. It's so out of my realm of experience. It's not something I have been taught to expect. Nobody prepared me for this. And so in talking to people who have had near-death experiences, who have had some of these profound experiences, like my husband, it takes time to, if it's the first go-round with something like this, it takes time to integrate it back into life. Suddenly, things that we complain about in everyday life seem trivial, and we feel alienated from others, and oftentimes we see how much pain there is in the world, and we can't see the joy at all. And we have all these feelings surface, and so, as I said before, it's almost like a teardown of everything we thought was real because we've been presented with something that there's this term in psychology called cognitive dissonance, which is two opposing ideas coming together at the same time. And this is a perfect example of that. So here we have a situation like this, like my experience in the psychomantium, my husband's near-death experience, somebody else's after-death communication, that goes totally against everything that society has been telling us. And so it's quite a shock. It can be a physical shock. I remember going to an IANS meeting, International Association for Near-Death Studies. Actually, it was a conference. And it was a group. They were having a meeting of experiencers. And I became incensed that they wouldn't let me talk about my experience, and I needed to talk about it so badly. Well, of course, they're not going to let me talk about it. It was for near-death experiencers. Okay. I think they could have been a little more generous, but I really was beside myself because I was having such a hard time talking about it. My husband, he didn't want anybody knowing about his near-death experience for a number of years. He didn't want to talk about it. So for those of us who have had these experiences for the first time, yeah, there is that sense of being beside ourselves. I think that after that, we can have these experiences and we're more prepared. And it's not quite so overwhelming. And if we've done our work, if we've done our own personal work and taking care of some of the issues, the earthbound issues that we need to address, also the spiritual encounters aren't so frightening.
Right. Well, it's a fantastic experience. It reminds me of the time many years ago when I was learning how to see auras, and you possibly know this already. You have to, in fact, focus behind the person you're looking at and not at them. And I wondered, when you were talking about looking into this mirror, do you think that is what happened, that because you were focusing on the mirror, you were able to see these other occurrences, or do you think they would have happened anyway?
Oh, I think it would have happened anyway. I think the situation was right, because I've seen auras, and it is, and you are absolutely right. It is about looking behind the person, and especially if colors are involved. This was so out of the realm. This was, from what I understood after talking with the facilitators, is that people who have had full-blown apparitions appear to them with the psychomantium, that initially what happened was that they saw orbs and they saw mist and vectors of light. Now, what I think for my situation is that my deceased loved ones knew how skittish I was.
Yes.
And that they made a decision to present this specific way. So I think that for whatever reason, that was the right time for it to happen. That for whatever, maybe it probably had something, I'm sure it had something to do with me. Maybe I was not receptive at all. Maybe I was being too withholding, skeptical. Also, I was grieving about my grandmother. And when I went and I sat down in this psychomantium, it was kind of like, okay, whatever. I just went and sat down. And that's when I've had most of these experiences, is when I have least expected them. And then all of a sudden, something happens. When I try really, really hard, then it doesn't happen. Recently, I was with somebody who was really, 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 really angry, and they didn't look angry from appearances face to face, but their aura did give them away. And I had no expectations of seeing what I saw. So I know a lot of people, what they will do is they will become very involved and they will pay huge sums of money to go and participate in certain workshops. Now, of course, there are some very bona fide workshops out there, don't get me wrong. But they will pay huge sums of money in order to facilitate one of these experiences. And they will try so hard, and then they will become so despondent because nothing is happening. When the bottom line is, I think that, and a lot of others, not just myself, will say this, the easiest thing that we can do is we can start to meditate. We can begin to get into a ritual of meditating, and everybody's going to do it a little bit differently. The first time I started meditating, I used the old standby. I would put a candle on the table, and I would light it, and I would stare into the flame. And as long as I was staring into that flame and focusing in on that flame, I didn't have to think about a bunch of other stuff. One medium I know, what she does is she counts backwards from 100. Other people I know, they say a mantra, a nonsensical mantra that has no meaning. Other folks, what they do is they lie down. Some people sit up. Some people have their eyes open. Some people have their eyes closed. But it's about finding some sort of discipline that works to begin to calm down, to clear the mind of clutter, because it's all around us. This is all around us. I mean, these other dimensions, they aren't off somewhere. They intersect with ours. And what we need to do is we need to learn how to be able to be receptive. And not receptive where I'm sitting there intently and I'm looking and I'm waiting and I'm hoping and I'm praying. Not that sort of in experience, but more of if we can discipline ourselves to not have so much clutter going on, and if we can clear away the wreckage of the past, and if we can tidy up maybe some of the wreckage we've got going on in the present. We can also get great solutions doing meditation with regard to problem solving in the here and now. Yes. If we can quiet our minds, and if we're having some, I had a difficulty just last week and was doing some meditating and got the solution and wasn't even looking for the solution. Mm-hmm. So, and then we're also more receptive to those nudges, because I do also think, as you said, that the door is open for everybody. Everybody can have this opportunity, not just a few. We don't have to come close to death in order to experience some of these things, but everybody can have these experiences. But I think that if we can just quiet our minds a little bit, then, and if we cannot, and if we're not trying so hard, but at the same time disciplining ourselves to be responsible for ourselves, I think that, sure, we can have some of these experiences.
Yes.
I'm the perfect example.
I agree with you where meditation is concerned. Now, just coming back to these ideas of mirrors, do you think there is some truth in the fact, the allegation that if you stare into a mirror at your own image and you keep focusing on it, eventually it will be transformed into a face from one of your previous lives? I mean, I've heard that said, although I've never known of anybody who's experienced it.
I have heard the exact same thing, and I have never tried it myself either. And maybe someday when I don't have two young men living in my household, I'll be able to try it for myself. But from what I've read, the experiences have been pretty profound. So once again, what it is, it's about reality. It's about, what is our definition of reality? Is our reality a canned sort of perception of the living experience? Or are we going to open ourselves up to a greater reality? And so that's just one more aspect of the greater reality. My experience in doing the psychomantium, never in a million years do I think I would have experienced that if I also hadn't been in a place where there was a part of me that had begun to seek out some information. I was willing to look at the possibility of a greater reality. So, who knows?
Indeed. Now, I'll tell you a funny little thing that I read recently, which sort of in a way relates to what we've been talking about. I never realized till I read this little article, assuming it's true, of course, what is meant by people having a wake. And what this little article said was that it was in the days when they used to leave the body in the coffin, maybe for 2 or 3 days, and they called it a wake because sometimes the person wasn't dead and they would wake up. So it sounds
I love those accounts.
Yes,
did you hear about
feasible.
The bell in the coffin?
Just beg your pardon?
Did you hear about the bells in the coffin?
I've heard about the strings attached to people in the coffin when they've been buried so that if they're alive, they can pull the string. Is that what it is, with a bell on the end?
Exactly, yes. There would be, because they didn't understand, you know, decades ago when somebody appeared to be dead, they weren't really dead. And so people were buried alive. And so there were even, I even read some account where the wealthy, as recently, with the beginning of the telephone, that somebody had even put a early receiver telephone in the coffin because there was the fear that they would be buried alive. So I think that back then things were a little bit different. Well, back then, like I said, when somebody died, they usually died at home, and then they were laid out on the parlor table, and they were washed and cared for, and then people would sit with them for 3 days. Because you had to sit with them because the belief was the spirit was hovering above the body. And so, of course, then we had individuals who were buried, and they were maybe somebody didn't sit with them for 3 days, and they woke up and they found themselves in a very difficult predicament. So, yeah, that's not a good thing.
No, indeed. Now, you mentioned your two sons, and before we close the program, I must ask you to tell our listeners about that wonderful little story where your two sons were talking about their grandfather just a few weeks before he passed on. You probably know what I'm referring to.
Oh, yes. My father-in-law was, he was a formidable individual. My in-laws, they escaped World War II, leaving family behind. They came through France, and they came to the States. And then my father-in-law reenlisted and went back as a medic during World War II. Mm. And so he really was just seen as a superhero for both my boys. And they called him Doc. And my father-in-law was Polish, but he spoke Russian, Polish, French, Hebrew, and I'm probably French, and I'm Italian, and I'm sure I'm leaving some languages out. But we moved my in-laws to be closer to us as they got up in years, and so they were a block away from us. And so my children, when they were younger, they would go over there and sit and watch Doctor Who and eat popcorn and tell horrible jokes. And so living on an island, especially at that time, there weren't a lot of options here. And I'm pretty much vegetarian with maybe fish once in a blue moon. And so I have to drive off the island to go get my needs taken care of. And so Josh and I, my youngest son, we were driving off the island, and Josh started talking about how tired he was. And he wanted me to come in the back seat and give him a cuddle in the back. Mm. And I said, I can't. I have to drive the car. And he said, let Domus drive the car. And at that time, my father-in-law had become very ill. He was obviously going to be passing soon. And I thought to myself, the mental health professionals thought, my son is having stress-related imaginary friends. And so he described Domus as this red-headed kid that was sitting next to him. And he was incensed that I wouldn't let Domus drive the car. And so Domus became constant conversation. We just went with it. And I would say to Josh, well, is Domus here? And he would say, yes, Domus is here. He's sitting right here. And then he would give me that look like I was just crazy because I couldn't see Domus. And even Aaron, my older son, he even played along with it and said, well, is Domus here? Yes, Domus is here, Aaron. And so we were at the office. It was we had an office in a 100-year-old house that was haunted. It was a great old house. But anyway, we were there picking up the mail, and there was a possum that had died in front of the house. Uh-huh. And so my son looked at the possum and looked at his dad and then said, the possum went to the sky. The possum went to the sky, just like Da. Da's going to go to the sky. And my husband said, who told you Da's going to the sky? Well, Domus came. He's going to take him to the sky. And then Josh went and picked up his dinosaur toys and climbed in the car, and Michael just stood there with his mouth hanging open. Well, Friday the 13th, the day after Hanukkah, which is was my children's favorite day, of course, because of presents. We were sitting with a rabbi friend of ours, and I said to this friend, thankfully an open-minded clergy, I said, my son, Josh, has been talking about an imaginary friend, about somebody named Domus, who's here to take Dot to the sky. And so Jimmy wrote the word Domus out in Hebrew, and then he wrote it out in Aramaic, and he said, oh, my goodness, that's a ancient term for the angel of death. And he said, where on earth did Josh get that? And I said, I don't know. That evening, my father-in-law passed in my husband's arms, Friday the 13th. A lot of times people will die on certain days. So he waited the day after the Hanukkah season. Having a wicked sense of humor himself, he died on Friday the 13th after the 10 o'clock news in my husband's arms very peacefully. So once he passed, and of course we sat with the body, and we had to lead a hospice worker out of the room because she could not handle the fact that we as a family had no problem sitting there with my father-in-law's corpse. It was kind of that's like a bad sitcom right there. But when I got home, I asked Josh, I said, well, is Domus still around? Are you talking to Domus? And Josh looked at me and said, no, Domus went to the sky with Da. And that was that. So we still talk to Josh. Josh is now 6'4", and we still talk to him about his experiences with Domus. Now, shortly after that, my oldest son had after-death communications from his grandfather, where his grandfather came to him and let him basically know that he would be watching over him and he would always be there for him.
Lovely. Well, I thought I'd get that one in because I thought that was a very lovely story. Well, would you like to give your website address and tell our listeners where they can obtain your latest book, or any of them for that matter?
Well, what they can do is they can go to Amazon.com, and they will all three books on Departing Visions will be listed, along with my other titles. Or what they can do is they can go to my webpage, www.CarlaWillsBrandon.com. There's some information there on Departing Visions. Also, they can go to Carla Wills Brandon Author Digs page on Facebook, and I put videos up and information on Departing Visions, near-death experiences, after-death communications, reliable. I just posted a medium, a real true blue. This is how you're supposed to do it if you are a medium with the Spiritualist Church in England. Video up. She's delightful. I think her name is June. Or they can go to YouTube and they can just Google Carla Wills Brandon. And I put up a video about some aspect of the Departing Vision at least once a month.
Right. Now, that second website address you gave me, could you repeat that? You gave me Carla Wills Brandon, the first one. What was the second one you mentioned?
That one is Carla Wills Brandon, yeah. Author Digs.
Is that all one word? So author, voice, is there a break there?
Yeah, there's breaks in all the words. But it's Carla Wills Brandon, and then in quotation, it's author digs, and then quote page.
Okay, fine. I mean, is there a link, or is that also listed on your main website anyway?
Let me see. I can pop it up right now for you. I decided to put that up because I wanted to have something that was more geared toward the Departing Vision. But it's morphing a little bit. So, let's see here if I can get it for you. Here it is. That is www.facebook.com/pound!/CarlaWillsBrandon.
Okay, fine. I think that about covers it now. It's been great talking with you. You certainly have a good, very good memory for all these different things that you you spoke about. You could have spoken on a lot more, I guess.
Well, I really appreciate you inviting me to be on your show.
Well, I'm pleased you came. That was very interesting, even to me, who I feel I'm a bit of an old hand in all this. But it's still very nice to hear of these different experiences. It's reassuring, and well, it's simply interesting anyway. So anyway, thank you very much. Is your new book already released?
Yes, it has been released. So it was released actually Thanksgiving Day. So it's out and about, hobbling around, getting into the hands where it needs to be. So
right.
That's how I look at it. The information is there. And one other thing, you know, the thing, you just said something very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, just when I start to think that maybe I'm getting a handle on this, I find somebody else with a new paradigm. I find somebody else with new information. That's what's so incredible about all of this, is that it just continues. It just continues and continues and continues. So my latest venture is I've been looking into the physicist Thomas Campbell, who put together some of the mechanisms for going out of body with Robert Monroe.
Yes.
And so some of being a physicist, he's so black and white, but being a physicist, I love reading or listening to some of these individuals who, in their field, at one time they were so skeptical, and then to see where they have come with regard to their own skepticism. I just find it fascinating.
Absolutely, yes. Look, thank you very much again for coming onto the program. Time's gone so quickly. It's been so interesting, I think. So that's it for the time being. I wish you every success with your new book.
Well, you too. It was a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much. Right. Right, friends. As I invariably say, that was another very interesting guest. Next week, I have Marlies Carlin. She's a visionary pioneer and author, and she claims to bring peace and healing to the body, and she also offers a unique form of meditation. And let me see, I'm just checking here. Yes, and we're also going to talk about her latest book, which is called Simplicity of Stillness. So, fine. Thank you for being with me today. I do hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you very much.